one. And not all fights have been caused by my client, but yes, he was in a fight with his wife. Obviously, they are having problems, but they're trying to work things out. If we could all just take a deep breath, get Randy out of jail and back to work, I feel sure these two can iron out some of their differences. My client misses his children, and he really wants to go home. She's filed for divorce, Mr. Humphrey, the judge said sternly. Looks like she's pretty serious about splitting up. And divorces can be dismissed as quickly as they are filed. See it all the time, Your Honor. My client is even willing to go to one of those marriage counselors, if that'll make her happy. Annette interrupted. Judge, we're far beyond counseling. Mr. Humphrey's client is facing a malicious wounding charge and possibly jail time. He's hoping all of this will simply go away and his client walks free. That will not happen. This divorce will not be dismissed. Judge Battle asked, "Who owns the house?" Annette replied, "A landlord. They're renting." "And where are the children?" "They're away, out of town, in a safe place." Other than a few pieces of mismatched furniture, the house was already empty. Phoebe had moved most of their belongings to a storage unit. She was hiding in a motel in Grundy, Virginia, an hour away. Through an emergency fund, the legal clinic was paying for her room and meals. Her plans were to move to Kentucky and live near a relative, but nothing was certain. Judge Battle looked directly at Randy Fanning and said, "Mr. Fanning, I'm granting the relief asked for in this motion, word for word. When you get out of jail, you are not to have any contact with your wife, your own children, or anyone in your wife's immediate family. Until further orders, you are not to go near the home you and your wife are renting. No contact. Just stay away. Understood?" Randy leaned over and whispered something to his lawyer. Hump said, "Judge, can he have an hour to get his clothes and things?" "1 hour, and I'll send a deputy with him. Let me know when he's released." Annette stood and said, "Your Honor, my client feels threatened and frightened. When we left court on Monday, we were confronted on the front steps of the courthouse by Mr. Fanning's brother Tony and a couple of other tough guys. My client was told to dismiss the criminal charges or else. It was a brief altercation, but unsettling nonetheless." Judge Battle again glared at Randy Fanning and asked, "This true?" Randy said,
"I don't know, Judge. I wasn't there."
"Was your brother?"
"Maybe, if she says so."
"I take a dim view of intimidation, Mr. Fanning. I suggest you have a chat with your brother and get him in line. Otherwise, I'll call in the sheriff." "Thank you, Your Honor," Annette said. Randy was handcuffed and led away, Hump following along, whispering that things were going to be okay. Judge Battle tapped his gavel and called for a recess. Samantha, Annette, and Phoebe left the courtroom and stepped outside, half expecting more trouble. Tony Fanning and a friend were waiting behind a pickup truck parked on Main Street. They saw the ladies and began walking toward them, both smoking and looking tough. "Oh boy," Annette said under her breath.
"He doesn't scare me," Phoebe said.
The two men blocked the sidewalk, but just as Tony was about to speak, Donovan Gray appeared from nowhere and said loudly,
"Well, ladies, how did it go?"
Tony and his buddy lost every ounce of badness they'd had only seconds earlier. They backed away, avoiding eye contact and wanting no part of Donovan.
"Excuse us, fellas," Donovan said in an effort to provoke them.
As he walked by, his eyes flashed at Tony, who held the glare for only a second before looking away. After three straight dinners with Annette and her kids,
Samantha begged off, saying she needed to study and retire early. She fixed a bowl of soup on a hot plate, spent another hour on the seminar materials, and put them aside. It was hard to imagine running a general practice on Main Street and trying to survive on no-fault divorces and real estate closings. Annette had said more than once that most of the lawyers in Brady were just scratching out livelihoods and trying to net $30,000 a year. Her salary was $40,000, same as Maddie's. Annette had laughed when she said, "It's probably the only place in the country where the legal aid lawyers make more than the average private practitioner." She said Donovan made far more than anyone else, but then he took greater risks. He was also the biggest contributor to the clinic, where all funding was private. There was some foundation money, and a few big law firms from up north kicked in generously. But Maddie still struggled to raise the $200,000 annual goal. Annette said, "We'd love to pay you something, but the money's just not here." Samantha assured her she was content with the arrangement. Her internet connection was through Annette's satellite system, perhaps the slowest in North America. "It takes patience," she had said. Luckily, patience was plentiful these days, as Samantha found herself happily settling into a routine that included quiet nights and plenty of sleep. She went online to check the local newspapers, the Times out of Roanoke, and the Gazette out of Charleston, West Virginia. In the Gazette, she found an interesting story under the headline, "Eco-terrorists suspected in latest spree." For the past 2 years, a gang had been attacking heavy equipment in several strip mines in southern West Virginia. A spokesman for a coal company referred to them as eco-terrorists and threatened all manner of reprisals if and when they were caught. Their favorite method of destruction was to wait until pre-dawn hours and fire away from the safety of surrounding hills. They were excellent snipers, used the latest military rifles, and were proving quite efficient in disabling the 100-ton off-road coal mining trucks built by Caterpillar. Their rubber tires were 15 feet in circumference, weighed 1,000 pounds, and sold for $18,000 apiece. Each mining truck had 6 tires, and evidently these were easy targets for the snipers. There was a photo of a dozen yellow trucks, all idle and lined up neatly in an impressive show of muscle. A foreman was pointing to the flat tires, 28 of them. He said a night watchman was startled at 3:40 a.m. when the assault began. In a perfectly coordinated attack, the bullets began hitting the tires, which exploded like small bombs. He wisely took cover in a ditch while calling the sheriff. By the time law enforcement arrived, the snipers had had their fun and were long gone. The sheriff said he was hard at work on the case, but conceded it would be difficult to track down the thugs. The site, known as the Bull Forge Mine, was next to Winnow Mountain and Helly's Bluff, both over 3,000 feet in height and thick with untouched hardwoods. From deep in those forests, it was easy to hide and easy to fire at trucks day or night. However, the sheriff said that in his opinion, these were not just a bunch of guys with deer rifles having some fun. From wherever they were hiding, they were hitting targets 1,000 yards away. The bullets found in some of the tires were 51-millimeter military-style slugs, obviously fired from sophisticated sniper rifles. The story recapped recent attacks. The eco-terrorists picked their targets carefully, and since there was no shortage of strip mines on the map, they seemed to wait patiently until the mining trucks were parked in just the right places. It was noted that the snipers seemed to be concerned with avoiding injury to others. They had yet to fire upon a vehicle that wasn't parked, and many of the mines worked 24 hours a day. 6 weeks earlier, at the Red Valley site in Martin County, 22 tires had been ruined in a barrage that seemed to last only seconds, according to another night watchman. As of now, 4 coal companies were offering rewards totaling $200,000. There was no link to the Bullington mine attack 2 years earlier, where, in the most brazen act of sabotage in decades, explosives from the company's own warehouse were used to damage 6 dump trucks, 2 drag lines, 2 track loaders, a temporary office building, and the warehouse itself. Damages exceeded $5 million. No suspects had been arrested. None existed. Samantha dug through the newspaper's archives and found herself cheering for the Echo terrorists. Later, as she began to doze off, she reluctantly pulled up the New York Times. Except for a rare Sunday morning back in her New York days, she seldom did more than scan it. Now, avoiding the business section, she zipped through it but stopped cold in the dining section. The food critic was trashing a new restaurant in Tribeca, a hot spot she had been to a month earlier. There was a photo of the bar scene, with young professionals stacked 2 deep, sipping and smiling and waiting for their tables. She remembered the food as excellent and soon lost interest in the reviewer's complaints. Instead, she stared at the photo. She could hear the din of the crowd. She could feel the frenetic energy. How good would a martini taste right now? And a 2-hour dinner with friends, all the while keeping an eye out for cute guys. For the first time, she felt a bit homesick, but soon brushed it off. She could leave tomorrow if she wanted to. She could certainly earn more money back in the city than she was making in Brady. If she wanted to leave, there was nothing to hold her back. Chapter 12. The hike began at the end of a long abandoned logging trail no one but Donovan could possibly have found. The drive getting there required the skill and nerve of a stunt driver, and at times, Samantha was certain they were sliding into the valley. But he made it to a small opening, heavily shaded with oak, gum, and chestnut, and said, "This is the end of the road." "You call that a road?" she said, as she slowly opened her door. He laughed and said, "It's a 4-lane compared to some of these trails." She was thinking that life in the big city had done nothing to prepare her for this, but she was also thrilled at the thought of adventure. His only advice had been to wear boots to hike in and neutral clothing. She understood the boots, but the clothing required an explanation. "We have to blend in," he said. "They'll be watching for us, and we'll be trespassing." "Any chance of getting arrested again?" she had asked. "Slim. They can't catch us." The boots had been purchased the day before at the dollar store in Brady. $45, and a bit stiff and tight. She wore old khakis and a gray sweatshirt with Columbia Law across the front in small letters. He, on the other hand, wore green hunter's camouflage and state-of-the-art mail-order hiking boots with 1,000 miles on them. He opened the rear hatch of the Jeep and removed a backpack, which he slung over his shoulders. When it was in place, he removed a rifle with a large scope. When she saw it, she said, "Hunting, are we?" "No, it's for protection. A lot of bears in these parts." She doubted that, but was not sure what to believe. For a few minutes, they walked a trail that someone had used before, but not often. The incline was slight, the undergrowth thick with sassafras, red bud, foam flower, and red catchfly. Plant life he casually pointed out as if fluent in another language. For her benefit, he moved at an easy pace. But she knew he could sprint up the mountain any time he wanted. Soon she was panting and sweating, but she was determined to stay on his heels. It was mandatory for all single professionals in the city to own a gym membership, and not just any gym. It had to be the right one, the right place, and the right outfit, the right time of day or night to be seen sweating and grunting and getting properly toned for $250 a month. Samantha's membership had collapsed under the ruthless demands of Scully and Pershing, had expired 2 years earlier, and had not been missed in the least. Her workouts had been reduced to long walks in the city. Those, along with light eating habits, had kept the weight off, but she was far from fit. The new boots grew heavier with each turn as they zigzagged upward. They stopped at a small clearing and looked through the woods into a long, deep valley with mountain ridges in the distance. The view was spectacular, and she appreciated the break. He waved an arm and said, "These are the most biodiverse mountains in North America, much older than any other range. Home to thousands of species of plants and wildlife not found anywhere else. It took an eternity for them to become what they are." A pause as he soaked in the scenery. Like a tour guide who needed no prompting, he went on. "About 1 million years ago, coal began to form. Seams of it. That was the curse. Now we're destroying the mountains as fast as possible to extract it, so we can have all the cheap energy we can eat. Every person in this country uses 20 pounds of coal per day. I did some research into coal usage per region. There's a website. Did you know that the average person in Manhattan uses 8 pounds of coal each day that comes from strip mining here in Appalachia?" "Sorry, I didn't know that. Where do the other 12 pounds come from?" "Deep mines here in the east, Ohio, Pennsylvania, places where they mine coal the old-fashioned way and protect the mountains." He sat his backpack on the ground and pulled out binoculars. Through them, he scanned the view and found what he wanted. He handed them to her and said, "Over there, at about 2 o'clock, you can barely see an area that's gray and brown." She looked through the binoculars, focused them, and said, "Okay, got it." "That's the Bull Forge mine in West Virginia, one of the largest stripping operations we've seen. I read about it last night. They had a little trouble a few months back. Some truck tires were used as target practice." He turned and smiled at her. "Doing your homework, huh? I have a laptop and it can find Google and Brady. The Echo terrorists struck again, right?" "That's what they say. Who are these guys? Hopefully, we'll never know." He was standing slightly ahead of her, still gazing in the distance. And as he spoke, his left hand instinctively reached back an inch or two and touched the stock of his rifle. She barely caught it. They left the clearing and began the real climb. The trail, when there was one, was barely discernible, and Donovan seemed not to notice it. He went from tree to tree, looking ahead for the next landmark, glancing down to check his footing. The hike became steeper, and Samantha's thighs and calves began to ache. The cheap boots pinched the arches of her feet. Her breathing was labored. And after 15 minutes of silent climbing, she said, "Did you bring any water?" A rotting log made a pleasant resting place as they shared a bottle. He didn't ask how she was doing, and she didn't inquire as to how much longer they would hike. When they caught their breath, he said, "We're sitting on Dublin Mountain, about 300 feet from the top. It's next door to Enid Mountain, which you'll see in a few minutes. If all goes as planned, in about 6 months, Strayhorn Coal will bring in the dozers, thoroughly scalp this mountain, destroy all these beautiful hardwoods, scatter all the animals, and start blasting away. Their application for a strip mining permit is nearing approval. We've fought it for 2 years, but the fix is in." He waved an arm at the trees and said, "This will all be gone before we know it." "Why not at least harvest the trees?" "Because they're brutes. Once a coal company gets the green light, it goes crazy. They're after the coal, damn it, and nothing else matters. They destroy everything in their path, forests, timber, wildlife, and they run over anyone who gets in their way. landowners, local residents, regulators, politicians, and especially activists and environmentalists. It's a war with no middle ground. Samantha looked at the dense forest and shook her head in disbelief. She said, "It can't be legal." "It's legal because it's not illegal. The legality of mountaintop removal has been litigated for years. It's still in the courts, but nothing has stopped it. Who owns this land? Strayhorn does now, so we're trespassing. And believe me, they would love to catch me up here 3 days before the trial. Don't worry, though. We're safe. For about 100 years, this land was owned by the Herman family. They sold out 2 years ago and built a mansion on a beach somewhere." He pointed to his right and said, "There is an old family home just over that hill, about half a mile down the valley. Been in the family for decades. It's abandoned now, empty. It'll take the bulldozers about 2 hours to level the house and outbuildings. There's a small family cemetery under an old oak not far from the house. A little white picket fence around the graves. Very quaint. It'll all be shoved down the valley. Headstones, coffins, bones, whatever. Strayhorn doesn't give a damn. And the Hermans are rich enough to forget where they came from." She took another sip of water and tried to wiggle her toes. He reached into his backpack, removed 2 granola bars, and handed her one. "Thanks. Does Maddie know you're here?" he asked. "I'm living under the assumption that Maddie and Annette and Barb and probably even Claudel know just about every move I make. As you like to say, it's a small town." I've said nothing. "It's Friday afternoon and things were slow around the office. I told Maddie you asked me if I wanted to go sightseeing. That's all." "Good. Then we went sightseeing. She doesn't need to know where. She thinks you should settle the lawsuit, to at least get something for the mother of the 2 boys. He smiled and took a large bite. Seconds passed, then a full minute. And Samantha realized that long gaps in conversation did not make him uncomfortable. Finally, he said, "I love my aunt, but she knows nothing about litigation. I left her little legal clinic because I wanted to do big things, take on big lawsuits, get big verdicts, make big coal companies pay for their sins. I've had big wins and big losses, and like a lot of trial lawyers, I live on the edge, up and down, flush 1 year and broke the next. I'm sure you got a taste of that as a kid." "No, we were never broke. Far from it. I was aware that my father sometimes lost, but there was always plenty of money. At least, until he lost it and went to prison." "What was that like, from your standpoint? You were a teenager, right?" "Look, Donovan, you're separated from your wife and you don't want to talk about it. Fine. My father went to prison and I don't want to talk about it. Let's make a deal." "Fair enough. We should move on." They trekked upward, slower and slower as the trail disappeared and the terrain became even steeper. Pebbles and stones trickled behind them as they grabbed saplings to pull themselves up. At one point, as they stopped to catch a breath, Donovan suggested that Samantha take the lead so that he could catch her if she stumbled and slid backward. She did so, and he stayed close, with one hand on her hip, sort of guiding, sort of shoving. Finally, they reached the summit of Dublin Mountain, and as they emerged from the forest into a small, rocky clearing, he said, "We have to be careful here. This is our hiding place. Just over those rocks is Enid Mountain, where Strayhorn is hard at work. They have some security guys who occasionally pay attention to this area. We've been in litigation for over a year, and we've had a couple of nasty altercations. Such as? He removed his backpack and leaned his rifle against a rock. You've seen the photographs in my office. The first time we came here with a photographer, they caught us and tried to press charges. I ran to the judge and got an order which allowed us access on a very limited basis. After that, the judge told us to stay off their property. I haven't seen any bears. Why the rifle? Protection. Get down and come here. They crouched and walked a few steps to a gap between two boulders. Below them lay the remains of Enid Mountain, which in years past rose to 3,200 feet, but was now reduced to a pockmarked landscape of dust and rock and crawling machinery. The operation was vast, stretching from the remains of the mountain and jutting over the ridges around it. Mining trucks, hauling 100 tons of fresh, unwashed coal, bounced along a myriad of switchbacks, descending steadily like ants marching mindlessly in formation. A massive drag line, the size of her apartment building, swung back and forth, its bucket clawing into the earth and digging out 200 cubic yards of overburden and dumping it into neat piles. Loaders with smaller buckets worked methodically to scoop it up and dump it into another fleet of trucks that hauled it to an area where bulldozers shoved it down the valley. Lower on the mountain, or the mine site, track shovels dug coal from the exposed seam and dumped it into the mining trucks that slowly inched away when loaded, straining under their cargo as they bounced along. Clouds of dust hung over every phase of the operation. Donovan, in a low, somber voice, as if he might be overheard, said, "Quite a shock, huh?" "Shock is the right word," she said. "Maddie showed me three strip mines on the way to Colton on Wednesday, but we were not this close. Kinda makes you sick." "Yes, and you never get used to it. It's an ongoing rape of the land. A new assault every day." The violence was slow, methodical, and efficient. After a few minutes, he said, "In 2 years, they've knocked off 800 feet of the mountain. They've gone through 4 or 5 seams, with about that many left to strip. When it's over, Enid Mountain will yield about 3 million tons of coal, at an average price of $60 a ton. The math gets easy." They huddled close together, careful not to actually touch, and watched the desolation. A bulldozer shoved a load perilously close to the edge, and the larger rocks tumbled down a wall of fill 1,000 feet in height. The rocks bounced and fell until they were out of sight far below. He said, "And that's how it happened. Try and imagine the mountain about 500 feet higher, where it was 19 months ago. That's when one of those dozers pushed the boulder that traveled almost a mile before it hit the trailer where the Tate boys were asleep. He found his binoculars and began searching, then handed them to her. 'Stay low now,' he said. 'Far down in the valley there, beyond the fill, you can barely see a little white building. Used to be a church. Got it?' After a few seconds, she said, 'Got it.' Just beyond the church, there was a tiny settlement of a few houses and trailers. You can't see it from here. As I said, it's about a mile away and the trees are blocking the view. At trial, we plan to show a video that reenacts the path of the boulder. It actually flew over the church, probably at about 80 miles an hour based on its weight, and bounced once or twice, then banged into the Tate trailer."
"You have the boulder?"
"Yes and no. It weighs 6 tons, so we will not be hauling it into the courtroom. But it's still there. and we have plenty of photographs. 4 days after the accident, the coal company tried to remove it with explosives and machinery, but we were able to stop them. Thugs. Nothing but thugs. They actually showed up with a full crew the day after the funeral, entered onto property they had no claim to, and were all set to dismantle the boulder, regardless of how much damage they did to everything else. I called the sheriff, and there were some tense moments. You had the case 4 days after the accident. No, I had the case the day after the accident. Less than 24 hours. I got to the mother's brother. You have to be quick out here. My father would be impressed. Donovan glanced at his watch and looked at Enid Mountain. He said, they're scheduled to blast at 4 p.m., so you're in for some excitement. Can't wait. You see that odd-looking truck with the tall boom attached to the rear? Over there to the far left? Are you kidding? There are 100 trucks. It's not a haul truck. It's much smaller. All by itself. Okay, yes. I got it. What is it? Don't know if it has an official name, but it's known as the blasting truck. With the binoculars, Samantha zeroed in on the truck and the busy crew around it. What are they doing? Right now, they're starting to drill. The regulations allow them to go down 60 feet with a blast hole that's 7 inches in diameter. The holes are 10 feet apart, sort of in a grid. The regulations limit them to 40 holes per blast. Regs here and regs there. Lots of rules on the books. Not surprisingly, they are routinely ignored, and companies like Strayhorn are accustomed to doing whatever they want. No one is really watching, except for maybe an environmental group here and there. They'll take a video, file a complaint, and the company gets a nuisance fine, a slap on the wrist. Life goes on. The regulators are drawing their checks and sleeping peacefully. A large bearded man crept silently behind them and slapped Donovan on the shoulders with a loud boom. Donovan yelled, "Shit!" as Samantha yelped and dropped the binoculars. Stricken, they wheeled about and gasped at the grinning face of a burly man you wouldn't want to fistfight. "Son of a bitch!" Donovan hissed without reaching for his rifle. Samantha desperately looked for an escape trail. The man stayed low and laughed at the two. He stuck out a hand in Samantha's direction and said, "Vic Canzaro, friend of the mountains." She was trying to catch her breath and unable to extend a hand. "Did you have to scare the hell out of us?" Donovan growled. "No, but it sure is fun." "You know him?" Samantha asked. "Afraid so. He's a friend, or more of an acquaintance, actually. Vic, this is Samantha Kofer, an intern with Maddie's legal clinic." They finally shook hands. "A pleasure," Vic said. "What brings you to the coal fields?" "It's a long story," she said, exhaling, heart and lungs now working. "A very long story." Vic dropped a backpack and sat on a rock. He was sweating from the trek up and needed water. He offered a bottle to Samantha, but she declined. "Columbia Law?" he asked, looking at her sweatshirt. "Yes, I worked in New York until 10 days ago when the world crashed, and I got laid off, or furloughed, or something like that. Are you a lawyer?" She sat on another rock where Donovan joined her. "Hell no. I used to be a mine safety inspector, but managed to get myself fired. It's another long story." "We all have long stories," Donovan said, taking a bottle of water. "Vic here is my expert witness. Typical expert. Pay him enough and he'll tell the jury anything you want. Next week, he'll spend a long day on the stand, having a delightful time, clicking off a never-ending list of Strayhorn Coal's safety violations. Then the defense lawyers will eat his lunch. Vic laughed at this.
I'm looking forward to it, he said. Going to trial with Donovan is always exciting, especially when he wins, which is not very often.
I win as many as I lose. Vic wore a flannel shirt, faded jeans, boots caked with old mud, and had the look of a veteran hiker who could whip out a tent from his backpack and spend the next week in the woods.
Are they drilling? He asked Donovan.
Just started. Supposed to blast at 4. Vic checked his watch and asked,
Are we ready for trial?
Oh, yes. They doubled their offer this afternoon to 200,000. I countered at 950.
You're crazy, you know that.
Take the money and get something for the family. He looked at Samantha and asked,
Do you know the facts?
Most of them, she said. I've seen the photographs and maps.
Never trust a jury around here. I keep telling Donovan this, but he won't listen.
Are you filming? Donovan asked, changing the subject.
Of course.
They chatted for a few minutes as both men kept glancing at their watches. Vic removed a small camera from his backpack and took a position between two boulders. Donovan said to Samantha, Since the inspectors are not watching, it's safe to assume Strayhorn will break a few rules when they start blasting. We'll catch it on video and maybe show it to the jury next week. It's not that we really need it because we have so much dirt on the company. They'll put their engineers on the stand and they'll lie about how closely they follow all regulations. We'll prove otherwise. He and Samantha eased into positions next to Vic, who was filming and lost in his work. Donovan said, They fill each hole with a concoction known as ANFO, an acronym for a combination of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. It's too dangerous to transport, so they mix it on the site. That's what they're doing now. That truck is funneling diesel fuel into the blast holes, while that crew to the left there is rigging up the blasting caps and detonators.
How many holes, Vic?
I count 60.
So they're clearly in violation, which is typical. Samantha watched through binoculars as men with shovels began backfilling the blast holes. A wire ran from the top of each one, and two men were busy gathering them into a bundle. Sacks of ammonium nitrate were dropped into the blast holes, which were topped off with gallons of diesel fuel. The work was slow. 4 p.m. came and went. Finally, when the blasting truck backed away, Donovan said, It won't be long now. The grid was cleared as the crews and trucks disappeared. A siren sounded, and that area of the site became still. The explosions were a distant rumble as plumes of dust and smoke shot into the air, each blast only a split second after the one before it. The plumes rose in perfect formation, like fountains in a Vegas water show, and the earth began to crumble. A wide swath of ancient rock fell in violent waves as the ground shook. Dust boiled from the blast site and formed a thick cloud above it. With no wind, the cloud hung over the rubble, with nowhere to go. Much like a play-by-play announcer, Donovan said, They're blasting 3 times a day. Their permit only allows 2. Multiply all of this by dozens of active surface mines, and they're using about 1 million pounds of explosives every day here in coal country.
We got a problem, Vic said calmly. We've been spotted.
Where? Donovan asked, taking the binoculars from Samantha. Up there, by the trailer. Donovan focused on the trailer. On a platform next to it, 2 men with hard hats were apparently watching them through their own binoculars. Donovan waved. One of the men waved back. Donovan shot him the bird. The man returned the greeting. How long have they been there? He asked.
Don't know, Vic said, but let's get out of here.
They grabbed their backpacks and the rifle and began a hurried descent down the mountain. Samantha slipped and almost fell. Vic caught her and kept her hand tight in his. They followed Donovan, ducking around trees, dodging boulders, clawing through underbrush with no trail visible. After a few minutes, they stopped in a narrow open area. Vic pointed and said, "I came in this way. Call me when you get to your jeep." He disappeared into the woods and they continued downward. The trail was not as steep, and they managed to carefully jog for a few hundred yards.
"Are we okay?"
Samantha finally asked. "We're fine," he said calmly. "They don't know the trails like I do. And if they catch us, they can't kill us." She found little comfort in that. They picked up speed as the trail continued to flatten. The jeep came into view 100 yards away, and Donovan paused for a second to search for other vehicles. "They haven't found us," he said. As they drove away, he sent a text to Vic. All was clear. They bounced down the mountain, dodging holes and ravines wide enough to swallow the jeep. And after a few minutes, he said, "We're no longer on Strayhorn's property." He turned onto a paved road just as a large, dust-covered pickup truck raced around a curve. "That's them," he said. The truck moved to the middle of the road to block the jeep, but Donovan hit the gas and passed it on the shoulder. At least 3 rough-looking characters in hard hats were in the truck, scowling and looking for trouble. They stopped abruptly and began turning around to give chase, but the jeep left them behind. Racing through the back roads of Hopper County, Donovan kept one eye on his mirror and said nothing. "Do you think they got your license plate number?" she asked. "Oh, they know it's me. They'll run to the judge Monday morning and cry like babies. I'll deny it all and tell them to stop whining. Let's pick a jury." They passed the courthouse on Center Street in Colton. Donovan nodded in its direction and said, "There it is. Ground Zero. The ugliest courthouse in Virginia." "I was there Wednesday with Maddie." "Did you like the courtroom?" "It's kind of weird, but I'm not much of an expert on courtrooms. I've always tried to avoid them." "I love them. It's the only place where the little guy can go toe-to-toe on a level field with a big, crooked corporation. A person with nothing. No money, no power. Nothing but a set of facts can file a lawsuit and force a billion-dollar company to show up for a fair fight." "It's not always fair, is it?" "Sure it is. If they cheat, then I cheat. They play dirty, I get even dirtier. You gotta love justice." "You sound like my father. It's frightening." "And you sound like my wife. She has no stomach for the work I do." "Let's talk about something else." "Okay. Do you have plans for tomorrow?" "Saturday in Brady. The clinic is closed, so what are my options?" "How about another adventure? Does it involve guns?" "No. I promise I will not carry a gun."
"Will we trespass on someone's property? Is there a chance of getting arrested?"
"No, I promise."
"Sounds pretty dull. I'm in." Chapter 13. Blythe called bright and early on Saturday morning with the incredible news that she had the day off, a rarity in her world. Her employment situation had stabilized. Her firm had apparently stopped its bloodletting. No one had been shown the door in the past 5 days, and promises were finally trickling down from above. A gorgeous fall day in the city, with nothing to do but shop and worry about lunch and enjoy being young and single. She missed her roommate, and at that moment, Samantha was painfully homesick. She had been away now for only 2 weeks, but given the distance, it seemed like a year. They talked for half an hour before both needed to get on with their day. Samantha showered and dressed quickly, eager to ease out of the driveway before Kim and Adam came bouncing out of the house with a list of things to do. So far, it seemed as though Annette and her children allowed their guests to come and go without notice. She lived as quietly as possible and had yet to see them peeking through screens and around curtains. But she was also quite aware that most of Brady was curious about the alien from New York. For that reason, and because his marital situation was unstable, Donovan had suggested that she meet him at the county airport, 11 miles east of town. They would rendezvous there and begin the next adventure, the details of which he kept to himself. She was surprised to learn there was an airport within 100 miles of Brady. Late Friday night, she searched it online and found nothing. How can an airport not have a website? Not only was it missing a website, it also lacked aircraft, or at least none that she could see as the gravel road came to an end at the Noland County Airfield. Donovan's Jeep was parked next to a small metal building and was the only vehicle in sight. She walked through the only door she saw and crossed through what appeared to be the lobby, with folding chairs and metal tables strewn with flying magazines. The walls were covered with fading photos of planes and aerial shots. The other door opened onto the ramp, and there was Donovan, puttering around a very small airplane. She walked outside and said, "What's that?" "Good morning," he said with a big smile. "Did you sleep well?" 8 hours. "Are you a pilot?" "I am. And this is a Cessna 172, better known as a Skyhawk. I practice law in 5 states, and this little dude helps me get around. Plus, it's a valuable tool when it comes to spying on coal companies." "Of course. And we're going spying?" "Something like that." He gently folded down and locked a cowling that covered the engine. "Pre-flight is finished and she's ready to go. Your door's on the other side." She didn't move. "I'm not so sure about this. I've never flown in anything that small." "It's the safest airplane ever built. I have 3,000 hours and I'm highly skilled. Especially on a perfect day like this. Not a cloud in the sky, ideal temperature, and the trees are alive with the colors of autumn. Today is a pilot's dream." "I don't know." "Come on, where's your sense of adventure?" "But it only has one engine." "That's all it needs. And if the engine quits, it'll glide forever, and we'll find a nice pasture somewhere." "In these mountains?" "Let's go, Samantha." She slowly walked around the tail and to the right side door under the wing. He helped her into the seat and gently secured the seat belt and shoulder harness. He closed the door, locked it, and went around to the left side. She looked behind her at the cramped rear seat, and she looked in front of her at the wall of instruments and gauges. "Are you claustrophobic?" he asked as he snapped his seat belt and harness into place. Their shoulders were about an inch apart.
"I am now."
"You're gonna love it. You'll be flying it before the day is over." He handed her a headset and said, "Stick this on. It's pretty loud in here and we'll talk through these." They arranged their headsets. "Say something," he said.
"Something?"
Thumbs up. The headsets were working. He grabbed a checklist and ran through the items, carefully touching each instrument and gauge as he went. He pulled the yoke back and forth. An identical one on her side moved in tandem.
"Please don't touch that," he said.
She shook her head quickly. She wasn't touching anything. He said, "Clear," and turned the key. The engine jumped to life as the propeller began spinning. The airplane shook as he pushed the throttle. He announced his intentions over the radio, and they began taxiing down the runway, which seemed short and narrow, to her anyway.
Is anyone listening?
She asked.
I doubt it. It's very quiet this morning.
Do you have the only airplane in Nolan County? He pointed to some small hangars ahead, along the runway. There are a few more down there. Not many. At the end of the runway, he revved the engine again and rechecked the controls and instruments.
Hang on.
He pushed the throttle forward, gently released the brakes, and they were rolling. As they picked up speed, he calmly counted.
80 miles an hour, 90, 100.
Then he pulled the yoke back, and they left the asphalt. For a moment, she felt weightless, and her stomach flipped.
You okay?
He asked without looking at her.
Fine,
she said with clenched jaws. As they were climbing, he began banking to the left and completed a 180-degree turn. They were low, not far above the trees, and he picked up the main highway.
See that green truck parked down there in front of that store?
He asked. She nodded.
That's the asshole who followed me this morning.
Hang on. He jiggled the yoke and the wings dipped and rose. A salute to the asshole in the green truck. When it was out of sight, he began climbing again.
Why would they follow you on a Saturday morning?
She asked, her white knuckles digging into her knees.
You'll have to ask them.
Maybe because of what happened yesterday? Maybe because we show up in court Monday for a big trial? Who knows? They follow me all the time.
Suddenly, she felt a bit safer in the air. By the time they reached Brady, she was relaxed and taking in the scenery not far below.
He buzzed the town at 500 feet and gave her a bird's view of where she lived and worked. Except for a ride in a hot air balloon in the Catskills, she had never seen the Earth from such a low altitude, and it was fascinating, even thrilling. He climbed to 1,000 feet and leveled off as they skipped across the hills. The radio was as silent as the one in Romy's old fake patrol car, and she asked,
"What about radar and air controllers and stuff like that? Is anybody out there?"
"Probably not. We're flying VFR, visual flight rules, so we're not required to check in with air control. On a business trip, I would file a flight plan and get plugged into the air traffic system, but not today. We're just joyriding." He pointed to his screen and explained, "That's my radar. If we get close to another plane, it'll show up there. Relax. I've never had a crash."
"A close call?"
"None. I take it very seriously, like most pilots."
"That's nice. Where are we going?"
"I don't know. Where do you want to go?"
"You're the pilot, and you don't know where we're going?"
He smiled, banked to the left, and pointed to an instrument. "This is the altimeter. It monitors the altitude, which is pretty important when you're in the mountains." They were inching up to 1,500 feet, where they leveled off. He pointed outside and said, "That's Cat Mountain, or what's left of it. A big operation." Ahead and to her right was the strip mine, which looked like all of the rest, a barren landscape of rock and dirt in the midst of beautiful mountains, with overfill shoved far below into the valleys. She thought of Francine Crump, the client in search of a free will, and the land she wanted to preserve. It was somewhere down there, somewhere close to Cat Mountain. There were small homes along the creeks, a settlement here and there. The Skyhawk banked steeply to the right, and as it did a perfect 360, Samantha looked straight down at the mining trucks and loaders and other machinery. A blasting truck, front-end loaders, a drag line, mining trucks and haul trucks, track shovels, track loaders. Her knowledge was expanding. She spotted a supervisor who was standing beside an office, straining to watch the airplane.
They work on Saturday, huh? She asked.
He nodded and said, 7 days a week sometimes. All the unions are gone.
They climbed to 3,000 feet and leveled off.
We're over Kentucky now, heading west and north, he said. If not for the headsets, he would have been yelling into the roar of the engine.
Just look. Too many to count.
The strip mines dotted the mountains like ugly scars. Dozens of them as far as she could see. They flew directly over several. Between them, she noticed vast open areas, covered with patches of grass and a few small trees.
What's that? She asked, pointing just ahead.
That flat spot with no woods.
A casualty.
A reclaimed site that was once a strip mine. That one in particular used to be Persimmon Mountain, elevation 2,500 feet. They took off the top, got the coal, then set about to reclaim it. The law requires it to have the approximate original contour. That's the key language. But how do you replace a mountain once it's gone?
I've read about that. The land must be equal to or better than it was before the mining.
What a joke. The coal companies will tell you that reclaimed land is great for development, shopping centers, condos, and the like. They built a prison on one in Virginia, and they built a golf course on another. Problem is, nobody plays golf around here. Reclamation is a joke.
They flew over another strip mine, then another. After a while, they all looked the same.
How many are active as of today? She asked.
Dozens.
We've lost about 600 mountains in the last 30 years to strip mining. And at the rate we're going, there won't be many left. Demand for coal is rising. The price is up. So the companies are aggressively seeking permits to start stripping. He banked to the right and said, Now we're going north, into West Virginia.
And you're licensed to practice there? She asked.
Yes, and in Virginia and Kentucky.
You mentioned 5 states before we took off.
Sometimes I go into Tennessee and North Carolina, but not that often. We're litigating a coal ash dump in North Carolina. A lot of lawyers involved. Big case. He loved his big cases.
The lost mountains in West Virginia looked the same as those in Kentucky. The Cessna zigzagged right and left, banking steeply so she could take another look at the devastation, then leveling off to check out another one.
That's the Bull Forge mine straight ahead, he said. You saw it yesterday from the ground.
Oh, yes. The Echo terrorists. Those guys are really pissing off the coal companies.
That seems to be their intention.
Too bad you didn't bring a rifle. We could blow out a few tires from the air.
I've thought about it.
After an hour in the air, Donovan began a slow descent. By then, she was familiar with the altimeter, the airspeed indicator, and the compass. At 2,000 feet, she asked, Do we have a destination?
Yes, but first, I want to show you something else. Coming up on your side is an area known as Hammer Valley. He waited a minute for them to clear a ridge. A long, steep valley appeared.
We're going to start down here at the end of it, near the town of Rockville, population 300.
2 church steeples rose through the trees. Then the town came into view, a picturesque little village hugging a creek and surrounded by mountains. They flew over the town and followed the creek. Dozens of homes, mainly trailers, were scattered along narrow county roads.
This is what's known as a cancer cluster. Hammer Valley has the highest rate of cancer in North America, almost 20 times the national average. Bad cancers, liver, kidney, stomach, uterine, and lots of leukemia.
He gently pulled back on the yoke, and the plane ascended as a large hump rose before them. They cleared it by 200 feet and were suddenly over a reclaimed mine site. "And this is why," he said. "The Peck Mountain Strip Mine." The mountain was gone, replaced by small hills smoothed by bulldozers and covered in brown grass. Behind an earthen dam, a large body of black liquid sat ominously. "That's the slurry pond. A company called Stark Energy came in here about 30 years ago and stripped out all the coal. One of the first big removal sites in Appalachia. They washed it right here and dumped the waste into a small lake that was once pristine. Then they built that dam and made the lake a lot bigger." They were circling the slurry pond at 1,000 feet. "Stark eventually sold out to Kroll Mining, another faceless ape of a company that's really owned by a Russian oligarch, a thug with his finger in a bunch of mines around the world." "A Russian?" "Oh, yeah. We got Russians, Ukrainians, Chinese, Indians, Canadians, as well as the usual lineup of Wall Street cowboys and local turncoats. There are a lot of absentee owners here in the coal fields, and you can imagine how much they care about the land and the people." He banked again, and Samantha was staring straight down at the slurry, which, from 1,000 feet, appeared to have the texture of crude oil. "That's pretty ugly," she said. "Another lawsuit?" "The biggest ever." They landed on a runway even smaller than Nolan County's, with no hint that a town was anywhere close. As they taxied to the ramp, she saw Vic Canzaro leaning on a fence, waiting. They stopped near the terminal. There was not another aircraft in sight. Donovan killed the engine, ran through his post-flight checklist, and they crawled out of the Skyhawk. As expected, Vic drove an all-wheel drive muscle truck, suitable for off-road encounters with security guards. Samantha sat in the rear seat with a cooler, some backpacks, and of course, a couple of rifles. Vic was a smoker, not of the chain variety, but an enthusiastic one nonetheless. He cracked the window on his driver's side about an inch, just enough for half of his exhaust to escape while the other half whirled around the club cab. After the second cigarette, Samantha was gagging and lowered the rear window behind Donovan. He asked her what she was doing. She told him in plain language, and this touched off a tense conversation between Donovan and Vic about his habits. He swore he was trying to quit, had in fact quit on numerous occasions, and freely admitted that he fretted over the likelihood of an awful death from lung cancer. Donovan hammered away, leaving Samantha with the clear impression that these two had been bickering over the same issue for some time. Nothing got resolved.